So now let's see, how can we make selfies and employ really expensive hardware for it? So it's for us, no much cost, but for the city, it's a lot of cost. And you helped to save a little bit of the cost part. And here is Willem Westerhoff. And yeah, he's a hacker, and he hacked traffic cameras. And he wants to tell us today about how he did it and also how everything got better afterwards. So give a big applause to Willem.
Yes, so thank you. After my presentation Saturday, I obviously couldn't leave you with that bad feeling in your stomach. So today I actually have sort of a feel-good-ish story about what we hacked. I'm going to skip most of the introduction because I think most people know me, but basically I hack things. I do work for government, critical infra, OT, IoT, especially if it's cyber-physical, I'm interested. And today we're going to talk specifically about that picture, which we made from a traffic cam in this municipality of The Hague. So just to give you a bit of an outline, I'm going to talk about project context first, because this was a very big project for the municipality of The Hague. And they had quite some issues where they were also wondering about attacks from nation state actors and that sort of thing. And we really need to customize our approach a little for that. And then after that, I'll talk more in depth. How did we get in? How did we hack our way through these systems? What was the final impact of this? And then whatever lessons were learned. And just as a general disclaimer, I would like to get a little of a clap going for The Hague, because they actually fixed everything that we reported. So. And that took them quite a while, because this project was executed 2022, 2023, and it was mainly because there were 10 external parties involved and a gazillion devices and systems. So it was quite hard to actually get this fixed. So hence the clapping. At some point, we figured, you know what, let's just ask them, see if we can present about this, because most of the time we don't do that, but let's try, see if they are up for it. And they said, yes, go ahead. We would like to review your presentation for a little bit to make sure there's not details in there that we really don't want, but we do really want others to learn from our experience. So, again, not bad. I also like to warn you, do not try this at home at your local municipality. We tested this in live production systems, and that also means that if you fuck up, that the traffic lights go down, that the traffic cameras turned off. You should not do that unless, one, you know what you're doing, and two, you have permission to do so. This is a really back and forth between the people operating the system and accepting we can lose this traffic light for a little bit. Now, to give you a bit of context. So why did they start this project? Well, security was only part of the reason. There were a lot of issues functionally and regarding maintenance. So you had these older cameras in the network, and the imaging quality really wasn't great. And some also lacked like basic security features that they already knew about, or privacy measures to limit the impact of citizen tracking, basically, through privacy. But there was also the maintainability issue. Like, if they needed to do maintenance on a camera, they would need to get the third party there, make an appointment, walk with them towards or drive with them towards that specific site, and physically do stuff with it. And that just didn't really work for them in the long run. But security-wise was also a point, because they knew there were vulnerabilities in some of the system. They didn't know how widespread, but they definitely knew there were issues there. And back when they basically ordered or procured this setup, there were little to no cybersecurity requirements. This was done years ago. And with current state of things, current geopolitics, they were like, yeah, we really need to have a good hard look at this to get it fixed. Because first, they wanted to rebuild the network around it to make sure that at least the network is safe, even though the OT assets in there might still be vulnerable. And then after that, we're going to replace the entire camera environment, but we need to figure out with what. And that process is going to take quite a while, just like the entire process of fixing all these things, replacing the cameras, doing that. is going to take time. So what do we as a municipality need to take into account during that transition period and while we're making that new environment? And also, most importantly, what should we actually ask for when we are procuring that new environment and those new cameras? What sort of things are we looking at? And then along came Follow the Money. They made this article about the Dutch government does not know it is using Chinese cameras at a large scale. And then later on, another one which says the government is hanging the Netherlands full with Chinese repression cameras, which are pretty hefty titles. In the case of Den Haag, because I'm not going to criticize Follow the Money too much, they make very good articles. But in this case, Den Haag was very much aware of this. And they had already done their risk assessment again. They were reconsidering this, and they were working on the changes already, even like a year prior to these articles being released. And they do this all the time, especially for OT. So they were actually actively trying to change that, but especially in government projects, changing something takes quite a lot of time. But with Follow the Money, there was now a lot more urgency. There was more political pressure to get things done. There were questions being asked like, can you guarantee the privacy of our citizens? Can you guarantee the privacy of VIPs coming to The Hague? And especially in the context of nation states. But also, are we really in control? Do we know everything that's in there completely? Do we have knowledge that all our suppliers are completely okay? And one of those articles in Follow the Money actually talked about an existing backdoor in those cameras. So one of their worries was also that maybe hidden backdoors are already present in our systems. So yeah, we don't want to put systems with hidden backdoors in our new network. That's not a very good practice to do. And they also wanted to know, is our new network setup at least as secure as we intended it, or is there more that we should do there? So in the end, they figured out, you know what, we should probably get external experts in. We don't really know exactly what we want to take in scope and how to test this. So we're going to give you more or less a carte blanche to tell us what you think is the best approach given the context that we're going to supply with. Could be external, could be internal, could be theoretical, whatever. Make us a good project plan because we want to do this right. Now, then at that point, we started going to the drafting table. And one of the things they said was specifically take into account nation states. So the key question for us became actually threefold. Like, to what extent is the current environment properly secure? Yeah. Does it have vulnerabilities? Where, how, which ones? What should be taken into account while they're using this in the foreseeable future, while they're migrating to the new setup? And also, they've already made plans to mitigate certain risk. Will that do? Is that enough for what we find? And with that, we started drafting a project plan. And we basically split that into three setups. First off, threat modeling, which is basically a paper pen test, because we could do that while nothing is finished yet. We can talk about the designs with the people designing it, with the suppliers, with the people working in it, and have a debate on which vulnerabilities could be in there, which attack surface is there, and did you really think this through? But also because it provides us a lot of context for future tests. We know exactly where an attacker is likely to come in, so where we should do a scenario-based pen test from. And because we were able to do this all the way at the start, they can end up with a much more safer design or more secure design in general. Now, the second part was the threat hunting. Because of the known backdoors potentially in those cameras, we needed to assume that an attacker is already inside of those cameras. So we really need to search for malicious activity coming from these systems. And ideally, also do a quick and dirty, or maybe even more foolproof, check on those backdoored cameras to see if it really is there, yes or no. And then finally, you have like the detailed hacking part where we do a full technical assessments based on the outcomes of the threat model. And we review some of the configurations, we pen test from specific perspectives, and we focus during that entire track on those research questions. Is it secure enough? What else needs to be done, basically? However, project plan, reality usually don't end up in the same stage. My apologies. And one of the key things we hit was we did the threat modeling quite quickly, but somewhere down the line, government projects tend to get delayed. And the same happened here, so the technical assessment got moved up, and then moved up, and then moved up, until finally we got to do so. But this is also a part of those complex environments, because it is that huge of an environment, with that many supplier, with that many sites, you're gonna need a little bit of flexibility in there. Because sometimes we say, we have this requirement, we need this to do our work, and then the third party says, I'm not gonna give you that. So what are you gonna do, call it quits? So we really needed to have all the third parties and ourselves, you know, pour a little bit of water into the wine, figure out how are we going to do this together. So maybe you cannot give me admin rights to read everything myself, but maybe you can show me, like your admin shows me to a session and I can just look at things and tell you where to click. Will that work? And in that setup, we sort of improved our plan to make it work for Hague. And one of the things I also want to highlight is we actually recommended to you just a quick and dirty check on the IoT devices. Quick, is there a backdoor active? Can we see it somehow? But we're not gonna put too much time in it because we don't wanna do the full firmware analysis, because next week there's gonna drop a new firmware and all of that research will be useless. But they actually said, you know what? No, give us the full analysis, please. We want to really make sure that this is safe because we're going to use them for a little while longer and then we're going to swap them out, but we need to know that this version is really safe. And that was a good thing because in the end, because of that extra time, we actually did find some good stuff. Now, moving on to the hacking part. Threat modeling. Well, high level, we had 10 external parties involved. There were 250 sites across The Hague, all with its own unique set of IoT and IIoT systems. And in the Renew network, there was a center point, which was like the core router where all the traffic would go to. And within the municipality itself, there was a central part where there were a couple of servers that were working with this IT. And this was also the place where the normal employees interacted with. And they shared a bunch of architecture documents, design documents, that sort of thing. So they were really upfront in giving a lot of information. And at some point, we needed to stop preparing, just start talking and doing things because there's an infinite amount of pages to read here. Now, at a high level, what did we find? We found 17 threats in this design, so potential for danger. And I grouped the most important ones. And that is that not all of the third parties that were involved, which had VPN access, actually used MFA. Some were still on the single username password setup. There was also a lack of physical access controls at specific sites. So some sites were really secure physically, but others were fairly easy to open and get access to. And the second part of that problem was that once you're in such a decentral site, there appears to be a lack of network segmentation, especially in those decentralized sites. So once you're in one site, you can access quite a lot in the other sites as well, and in the central parts of the environment as well. And we also looked a bit at the supply chain for their IoT systems. And there were some what we call known dangerous suppliers, especially in the context of nation states. So devices which we know belong to Chinese corporations that have worked with similar Chinese government influence or have planted backdoors in the past, which is not something you want in these kind of setups. We also figured out that if we would get some malware, some phishing on the right systems, that it'll grant us network access remotely, either through the VPN or just by taking their cookies. And that the central part of the system had no detection or prevention options. So it could traffic would go through it, but it would not get detected or responded to immediately. That would be an afterthought, which would be a manual response. And also given the variety of systems, given the variety of suppliers, it would be quite hard to maintain this properly. But again, this was all based on the paperwork, the interviews, the design, and as we know, design doesn't always meet practice. So we did recommend, let's do a thorough test once this is more or less underway. Now moving on to the threat hunting part, we wanted to find out if there are backdoors there. And we had to do that because we know that there might be, we have reason to think that they are. And logging of IoT systems is pretty damn poor. Most of the time, there's nothing you can actually base this on. So we had to work with the network behavioral-based things. And hence, we had to go to the third party again, or one of those third parties, and say, hey, can you help us out? Can you give us information about your network logging? Can you give us access to the routers? Can you give us something? And we ended up doing a review of basically the firewall rules, so the access control list of the central environment as well as the decentral environment, and threat hunting with their admin together to get the information. And this wasn't an easy issue, like any to any is open, but it also wasn't good. When we reviewed the rules, we noticed that internet access was blocked. Okay. But if you're on the VPN, you can reach everything. So the guy controlling the cameras or maintaining the cameras could also attack the traffic light installations or the signs above the road, which is not something they need or should be able to do. And this meant that also decentralized traffic, that actually, if that would send traffic, it wouldn't go to the central router if it could communicate directly with other decentral sites. So only the decentral ACL was applied and not the central ACL, which meant that decentrally, you basically had a any rule. You can move from one site to the other, more or less. And this was mainly due to a combination of rules triggering at different levels and not being implemented in the right way or in the right order, which meant that in the end, you could reach far more than you should. And also decentrally, the router would block things or drop traffic, but it wouldn't log anything. So you can't actually, in the threat hunt, see what is being blocked, which is a big issue for us. We also noticed that various unencrypted traffic streams were allowed, so that would be interesting for the later technical text, and you know, all sorts of minor issues like naming schemes, you know, the best practices for firewall, especially in a system that is already hard to maintain. You really want to set that up well, because otherwise it's going to end bad. Now, under the assumption that those cameras were breached, we lined up 15 research questions specifically to find, are these breached? So are there any devices that attempt to connect to hosts on the internet? What is normal behavior for a traffic camera? And are there any outliers in those connections? Like, is there a session open for multiple days or only a lot of sessions for a single device? And we got access to 31 days, so 1 month of NetFlow data to do this. And we pushed that into an Elk stack. This is just gibberish from the internet. This is not actual data. And what we found there was the first and most foremost thing was that what was normal for these systems was completely unknown to the vendor that needed to analyze the traffic. They had no idea what normal behavior was for these devices, which is a yellow flag, I guess, because they are the one that should be judging if something bad is happening, yes or no. We also found that connecting to the internet systems from the decentralized part is blocked, but it's blocked locally and therefore not visible centrally, which means that if such a camera decentrally is trying to communicate with some server in Russia or China or whatever, we're not going to see it in this data set, which sucks, but silver lining, at least it's getting blocked. So we know it's not getting out in the open. Now then, looking more into what can we do with this data set, because apparently there were quite some limitations, figured out that, you know, at least the devices all show similar behavior. So if they all show similar behavior, it's unlikely that they're all compromised. It's more likely that they're functioning as intended. We also noticed that some of those unencrypted protocols were used in practice. And we found that SSH was also used, but long term. Like there were sessions, tunneled sessions, I guess, which lasted for over 30 days, which is the entire data set. And you know, there were also just lengthy ones for very specific cameras, and we didn't really understand why. Now, then we found some more misconfigurations in the sense that systems that tried to reach out to systems that were now unreachable or used disallowed protocols. And in the end, one of our fun findings was that there was a monitoring rule for a third party. This was a different third party for the record. And that rule had 0 bytes transferred. So what are you monitoring? Question mark. And our conclusion was, yeah, this is always the hard part with threat hunting. Like, we see weird things, but this could very well be legitimate. But you really need to talk to your suppliers, because it's most likely a sysadmin of that third party doing some weird shit, but it could also be something bad. And they did, and luckily for us, there were no real signs of an active breach, but this did fix a lot of false positives that would normally end up in the logging that now no longer do so, and it fixed quite a number of misconfigurations in those devices. But there were obviously a lot of ifs and buts regarding how much can we actually see and how much can we actually threat hunt. Now, moving on to the part that you probably like more, the hands-on hacking. When we started hacking, we're gonna check from three perspectives, namely the remote check on those VPNs. We were looking into testing from a decentral site, so a random field location, and we were having a test site set up at the main location of The Hague, where we could try first and then move to a field site to try again, basically. And the goals were either get access to the live feed, the archived feed, try and remove the privacy barriers, and bonus, if you find anything else that would be interesting for a nation state, please let us know. See what you can do there. So I'll go through this with the unified kill chain, which is basically going in, hacking through, getting out. Now, first off, the remote attack surface. Obviously, there were a bunch of minor findings like, hey, you have weak encryption protocols, there's a self-signed certificate here, the kind of findings that you'll put in a report, but you don't really care about too much, right? But there was one that was more interesting, which was the Ike scan we did. And that was set up with aggressive hash protocol. So it would actually, if you connect there, send you the password hash, and you only need to prove that you can verify it, basically. So that way you can get the hash out of the system by just connecting, and you can try and offline crack it to then prove that you're the admin. Now, we tried to offline crack it, but no cigar, it was a limited time project. But for a nation state, this might be feasible depending on how difficult the password set is. So we put it in the report, but with a question mark. And another way was to go to those decentral locations, because those are in public spaces, like they're out there on the street. So what if we just go there, plug our computer in? What'll happen? And we got guided by someone of the municipality, and one of the things we noticed was there was one key to rule them all here. Like there is one key, it was a very good key, it was for a solid lock, but one key opened all of these cabinets. So if someone clones that key, loses that key, those are a lot of locks that need to be replaced, and in practice, those probably aren't gonna be replaced. So that would be an interesting way of getting in. Now, there were also a lack of anti-brute force measures. So in some cases, you could basically get a screwdriver to open up these places. And it depended on where you are, but in quite a number of cases, you could get into this network cabinets using nothing more than simple toolbox. And once you open it, there were either no sensors in most of them, and in those where there were sensors, there was no active alerting going on. So even if you pulled it open, no active alert would be sent, or it would end up in some inbox that no one ever looks at, basically. And from that point on, you could just attach, plug and play. You now have network access. Have fun. And the third one would be the backdoor through a supply chain. Again, we had the Higgs Vision backdoor. These were the cameras that we were talking about, that they talked about in Follow the Money. And the municipality of The Hague actually went into the field, unscrewed three of the cameras that were in the field, and gave them to us, and replaced them with new ones. And basically, that those were our device under testing, so taken directly from the production line. And those were two different build versions, so you had a slightly older model and a slightly newer model for us to look at. And what we found there was, when we opened it up, there was no clear chip or something, like a 4G or a SIM, or that would indicate a out-of-band backdoor. So well, that's good news, I guess. But what we did found was UART, which is basically a debug protocol at the hardware directly, where if you plug a cable onto that, you get a shell once you boot the system. And with that shell, if you type in the right commands during boot, you could set it to single user mode, and you would instantly be root on the device, as long as you have physical access. But with that root account, because you know physical access to get somewhere, it's something, but it doesn't escalate our privileges, you could grab the weak hash out of it for the web application and crack that offline, because it was just a simple MD5 format. And then that would give you the password usable for the web app, which was actually shared between almost all of the cameras. So you take one down, break it open, crack the password, get back into the network, control all the cameras, which is quite interesting to do during some riot in The Hague. Another one was the password reset feature, and this was one of those things where we took a long, hard look at this. If you want to reset your password because you lost it somehow, you need to get in touch with the vendor. But what you need to do, and what happens in practice, because we reverse engineered this, is that you send a network command to the camera, and the camera replies back basically with a public certificate. And then you send the public certificate back to the vendor, and they will sign it with their private side of the certificate, and then you can use whatever comes out of that to reset your password. However, that also means that if someone from the vendor has network access to your system, they can send the request to get the public certificate to your camera and do that reset entirely without your permission. So in the context of a vendor working with a nation state, this is very dangerous because they can get in whenever they want to. They do not need your permission to do that. So, design choices. And to summarize that, for remote attack surfers, password hash disclosure might get you in. For the physical attack surface, it's quite easy. You go there, you plug in, meh, or you copy a key with a little bit of social engineering, or maybe soliciting the right person. And the backdoor through the supply chain is definitely there in multiple ways. If the vendor wants to own your systems, he can, as long as those systems have network access. So again, this was a good setup where the systems did not have internet access. Now then, hacking through. So at some point, we plugged in to the decentral sites. And obviously, we're going to start with attacking the central systems, because those are sort of the heart of the operation. Let's see there. And those were reachable from the decentral network, not on all ports, but on quite a few. And what we found on the central servers was a known six-year-old critical exploit in the middleware called Apache Struts. Not sure if anyone's familiar with that. I think most of you. So from that point, Metasploit hit a couple of enters, typed the right IP, and we were in with admin privileges on the central server. And once in, there turns out there was no antivirus, so we used Mimikatz, got the credentials out, our Windows-level credentials, RDP'd our way in, and we now have full desktop-based access. So it's time to start pillaging. And in that part of pillaging, basically, from the application, took the database out, found the encryption key, decrypted all the credentials per camera, and only then we found that most of the credentials were actually duplicate, so we sort of already had those. But it's another way to do it. And in that process, we also found the credentials for the recordings. So the server, the initial server, needed to send his recordings to the next server, and those credentials were also in there. So this just gave us access to the cameras, as well as access to the recordings. But then I said, okay, guys, we're a team here, we need to do quite a lot. We can call them on this one exploit they missed, but let's just have a look at the web app itself as well. Because if they patch it, I don't think that fixes everything here. So we went to the web app, and we tried some user enumeration, looked into brute forcing, and that seemed possible. So let's start looking for some weak credentials. And we load up our burp intruder, type username test, password test, hit login, and it says 200 OK. And I'm like, huh? What did I do wrong? Is something wrong? So I go to the web app, enter username test, admin test, and I'm signed in. There was a test account in the production system with username test, password test, and that actually gave full view rights to all the cameras. Yeah, that hurt quite a lot. And then when we dumpster dive using that account for a little bit, we also found actually the admin password.txt in the dumpster to use for the admin role. So then another way, because we were decentral anyway, was those unencrypted streams. Can we actually see those decentrally? Because if you can only use them centrally, it's not that much of a big deal. It's a closed network. But decentrally is in the public space, so it's easier to get access to. So we checked, and indeed, we found real-time streaming protocol credentials in plain text, as well as X11 credentials being sent to the traffic lights and the human-machine interface. So that's like the manual override to set it to blinking orange if you're working on something there. So even if you were to plug in and stay in passive mode, you would be able to get those credentials out. Now, I talked a bit about network segmentation earlier, but a miracle happened in a bad way. But the access control level seemed pretty solid, but that central system somehow had internet connection. And we were trying to figure out why, and it turned out that that was a multi-homed system, which had a different line going out. So through the central system, you could actually get out. And what happened with the overall network setup was if you would either get in through the VPN or decentrally, then compromise the central parts, you could then, from the central part, get internet access and connect back to your server and use it as a hop. So if you get in anywhere, that would be pretty damn bad for The Hague, because the central systems were reachable from all parts where we could potentially get in. So yeah, I'm going to skip the summary because I think you're aware of it. But we got a lot of credentials, and there were just critical vulnerabilities in key servers. Now, for the getting out part, we wanted to upgrade our access. So on that central system, we had limited internet. There was internet, but not to all pages. But if you used the right ports, if you used the right interfaces, you could get out. So we just reverse shelled back to our host, connected back, and now we can exit it from our office, which is nice for testing, not so nice in general. But we could use it as a hop to the rest of the network. And having that live feed is one thing, but there were more flags. So using those credentials, it was possible to bypass the privacy limitations. So we removed here, this blue place. There it is there. There it isn't. It wasn't blue before, for the record. but you could basically remove those privacy limitations, and that would actually give you a lot more, which I'll talk a bit more about in the impact section. But it also enabled us, with any of these accounts, even the test account, to actually steer the camera to other angles when desired. So that's how you get to make a traffic cam selfie. For the record, it's not my first one. but you know, we came for the cameras. That was our objective here. But there was so much more there. We saw the traffic light installations. We saw the boards above the highway in the network. So we asked, hey, is it OK with you guys if we go a little out of scope and see what else is there and how if it's easy to get in? And they said, you know what? Go for it. Have fun. See what you can do. And what we found there was, well, a little shocking. But there were a lot of guessable credentials, either over Telnet or SMB. We also found that the human-machine interface were running on Flash. In combination with a weak password, so unsupported technology that you really don't want. But I think the key one was a lot of systems had FTP open with anonymous file write. And using that, you could actually push a configuration file or overwrite a configuration file, which made the traffic lights do different things. So instead of their normal 1 minute of red, 30 seconds green, next, or something like that, we could set it to 30 minutes red, 5 seconds green. Yeah, and at that point, you can let human nature do the rest. But you could also disrupt the HMI that way by just crashing it or making sure it doesn't work so that the manual overrides to set it to blinking orange doesn't work. Now, we also tried or considered the option of setting all lights green. That's a pretty bad practice to do in production systems, for the record, right? But lucky for us, there is a semi-analog safety system in here where if you set configurations that the system deems this is dangerous, it'll just fall back to blinking orange. So that scenario did not work. Now, when we look at the impact, if I were a nation state, this live and archived camera thing is quite nice because it's always good to keep track of things in The Hague, especially if you can do so remotely. And even more so if you can remove certain footage from the archives, because we also have access to the archives. And because you can also control and use those privacy bypasses, you can either move the cameras away at key moments, or you could remove those privacy screens to spy on embassies, ministries, international criminal court, the VIPs, that sort of thing. And for example, during the NATO summit, this would be a very interesting way to find VIPs that came to the Netherlands. And with those traffic light control, you can ensure that your escape route has all green lights and the rest is set to red. You can put all traffic lights either on blinking orange or the 30 minute red, 5 seconds green to just create one giant traffic jam there. But again, all green and really deliberately create crashes, that wasn't possible. However, I'd argue that if you do 30 minute red, 5 seconds green, and the next 5 seconds green, 5 seconds green, 5 seconds green, and then everyone 30 minutes red again, that'll in the end get you enough accidents as well, just because people are going to ignore the red light. Now, lessons learned. When we look at the research questions, was this environment properly secured? No, it's not, mainly due to all the legacy issues that were still in the network. However, it is now, which is really nice. And the worst case scenarios were all possible, so they really needed to do something more to mitigate these issues, and they now have fixed that so that the worst case scenarios aren't possible. And for to what extent it's not, is it possible to mitigate these further? Well, we said the network is mostly okay. It needs some tweaking in the firewall rules, but it's generally okay. But the individual systems really need a lot of work. And all of those systems were replaced. The network was really optimized. And for the future proposals, security demands were incorporated. And if you would like to prevent this because you're a supplier or a municipality, you know, it's really the basics, honestly, but set strong passwords and encrypt or hash them during transit or at rest. It's also about patches. Don't just install the Windows patches. Please also look at the rest of your software bill of materials. So, for example, the Apache level, the middleware level, or the plugins you put into your code. And obviously, you can also use configuration to limit attack surface and prevent exploitation of that attack surface if you know it's weak. And then finally, especially true in OT environments, is impact reduction. If you know there's vulnerable stuff there, assume a breach and figure out how you can lessen the impact. So don't use the same password on all of those devices, because if one device gets breached, you can hack them all. And don't use the same key in all those physical sites, because if the key drops once, you need to recover all the physical sites. And those kind of things. And there's quite a lot you can do with early warning, detects, alarms, alerts, monitoring, that sort of thing. Now, in the end, what we can say is that this upgrade in efficiency for them to work faster, to work better, did go hand in hand with a lot of added complexity. Like more, it became harder to do so. And also, really, you need to proactively look at your existing systems, because if you don't, you're going to fall behind, and this is the sort of mess that you get with. More importantly, you also need to manage your suppliers. You can update those security requirements in light of the current state of things. And maybe you would actually need to hire someone to do an independent check to say if they can back up their claim of doing it securely. But also, it's incredibly easy to make a minor mistake which leads to massive consequences. For example, setting the firewall rules in the wrong order. You set the right once, you just didn't get the order right, and now I have access to everything. And finally, design choices matter. So which part of your environment does what, and why does it do it? But also, if your supplier can reset your password without any sort of influence from you, or check with you to do that, that's weird. That you shouldn't make those kind of designs as a supplier. So for some final shout-outs, the project team, I won't name anyone specifically for de-anonymization, but the team really was awesome. There were a lot of people involved here, and also the third parties that helped us out. Follow the Money, they do a lot of hard research that need to be said, which others aren't saying, so thank you for doing that independent media thing. And also The Hague for letting us be on stage today and showing that their weak spot, which it quite was, and I've gone quite in depth on this, is actually something that others can learn from, because this isn't only The Hague where this is playing, but there are probably dozens more of municipalities where this is an issue with supply management, with the cameras being weak, and you know, obviously for fixing everything. And that was my presentation for today. If you have some questions, you can ask me now or add me on LinkedIn or send me an email.
Yeah, thank you. So, and you don't have to send an email because we have time for questions. So we have a mic here in front and one there in the back. So if you have any questions regarding traffic cams, traffic lights, hacking them. No, everyone is scared now to go on the street. And
it's the first question, so it's the hardest one, right?
Hi, thank you for a very, very interesting talk. I come from a very small village these days, and this immediately raises the question to me, and it has not been explicitly stated, I think. Why does the municipality need so many traffic cameras? What is it achieving with them? And what is happening to the data?
That is a very valid question. I think there were quite a number of people that have raised privacy concerns with this in general. I got to be honest with you, I am not 100% sure. I know for a couple of things where data goes or who was interacting with the system. One of those, for example, were police to track if vehicles are going certain places. For small villages, I really can't say, and I also think it differs per municipality. But there is a very clear basically agreement on what data can be logged and why, and who can access it and why for all of those cases.
Okay.
Any more questions?
Any more questions? Or, as you already said, you're also taking mails and also are still here for a while. So again, give a big applause to Wilhelm.